meeting to order. Senators Ellis, Senator Miller, and myself, Senator Rieger. Senator Saroff, the first bill before us will be Senate Bill 92 regarding REAA advisory votes. If you could speak very briefly to your bill, and in the meantime, we'll try to round up the fourth member so that we can move this forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Senator Jaroff, Senate District C. The bill is pretty well with backup material in your file there to give you an indication of what it is. But basically, the bill does is it allows a provision to be added to AS 1408-071 and relates to the REA schools. At this time, there is no provision that allows an advisory vote for any issues that may come up before the school district on the ballot for election of school board members. Most of the other school districts, I think all the other school districts, have that option available. They could do it through their borough assembly that's basically the way that it's put in there. But right now, if they want to do an advisory vote in an REA school district, they have to do it through their local advisory committees. And the Southeast School District that I represent has 17 schools, so you'd have 17 votes, and then it's compiling them. But this would be just an authorization to allow the Division of Elections to put the question on the ballot before the election of the school board members.
Okay, are there questions of committee members? Not Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I would move committee substitute for Senate CNRA out of committee with individual recommendations.
Hearing no objection, bill is moved out of committee with individual recommendations. The next thing before us is a 5-minute presentation from the people looking at the public health labs, which they have waited patiently all afternoon for us to fight over nuisances on. So the Hess people could please organize how they want to speak, but we are running real late, so I'd ask you to be concise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The health and safety of our public health laboratories has been of some question for a number of years. This has been repeatedly studied by outside experts, but we haven't really been able to pull together a comprehensive look at the public health laboratories. We have three labs, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, which we have leased facilities for close to 25 years. We're currently seeking options to protect public health, worker safety, and the quality of the products that we deliver. We've assembled a team, fairly distinguished team, Dr. David Verma, the Director of Public Health Laboratories in the state of Delaware. We have Doug Gordon, who is the Vice President of Architecture for Health and Science and Commerce, who has designed laboratory facilities. And who will speak today for us is Nolan Watson, the Principal and Senior Vice President of McClellan and Copenhagen, laboratory design consulting firm. They have gone over the three laboratories and are going to give you the benefit of their experience in this quick review that they did last week. So I'll turn it over to Nolan. If I can.
Before you leave, could you state your name just for the record so we have it clear, and then when you begin, please state your name.
Brian Saylor, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services.
Thanks.
And for the record, my name is Nolan Watson. I also want to mention this. We had 5 days, now I have 5 minutes, but I want to mention that we did have, in association with us, a director of safety, biological safety, from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, and that's a regulatory agency, an advisory agency. Let me just give you a quick overview of how public health laboratories fit in the overall scheme of, quote, public health, related to hospital labs and private labs. In fact, what happens, if you look at what happens as an outcome of a patient going through a laboratory procedure, or especially a multi-laboratory procedure, it's entirely different the outcomes of public health laboratories as a hospital. Obviously, a hospital is interested in taking care of that patient's problems right then and there. Public health labs, however, are looking at a bigger picture, epidemiological trends and everything else. The community health at large is at stake, and that's their mission of the lab, as opposed to public health lab or the laboratory, hospital lab, and private labs. Give you an idea from a laboratory standpoint what a laboratory is. And what we've done is try to diagrammatically show you the difference between, perhaps some of you have taken chemistry or biology. The black outline, in fact, is a standard teaching lab or any other biological lab or chemistry lab. So you have some casework, you have fresh air coming in, unlike an office, which usually brings fresh air in and recirculates it through. a laboratory, because you're using chemicals and carcinogenic materials and everything else, you want to exhaust all that out. Standard laboratory practice. CDC recommends it. Everybody recommends that you do this. Even if you go to a chemistry lab at a high school, you'll find they bring in all fresh air in. This is critical because it's expensive. And they take that air and exhaust all of it outside. The fuchsia, as a matter of fact, it takes it to the higher level where we're dealing with materials like TB. We're dealing with HIV in these laboratories. We have highly aerobic material, that is, airborne pathogens, things that can make people sick. People are working with those materials in these laboratories. In order to ensure worker safety, which is a critical thing we looked at, was our scope of work, they work in what's called a biological safety cabinet, a sort of a first order of safety. In other words, everything that's airborne pathogens are contained in this thing. Okay, now what happens, not only do we bring fresh air in, but we don't want to contaminate what we're doing. So we go through what's called a HEPA filter. It's a technical term, I know, but it's a filter that literally filters out all the airborne pathogens, all the biologicals. At the same time, we want to protect the public so that in case a spill happens in here, we'll do the same thing as we exhaust the air. So we bring in all fresh air, flood this place with about 12 air changes an hour, and then clean the air as it goes out. The same thing we're concerned about is materials are used in here, we have to, quote, decontaminate them. So we put them through an autoclave, again, a very expensive item. As you add it to a laboratory, we autoclave that material and you can either go into an incinerator or go into the waste stream. Now, if we've got liquid material coming out of here, liquid waste, we go through a kill tank. Again, a very expensive process, and you can see some up at the Fairbanks lab. What I want to do, just to give you an overview of what a laboratory is and why it's more complex than, let's say, a chemistry lab. Our charge was, what is the problem? The problem we found, one, you have all leased space. The state owns none of these laboratories. It's all approximately 30 years old. The laboratory practices have changed dramatically. We didn't have HIV 30 years ago. We didn't have as many airborne pathogens as we've identified. Real critical things to public health. What we found in Anchorage, this is just a quick overview, as I say, of what we found in these three sites. We have a major infection control problem at Anchorage Lab, because the lab, it was never designed as a laboratory. Much like Juno, was never designed as a laboratory. It's a developmental, or it's a developer's office space. It's more like this. And you certainly wouldn't want to try to adapt it to meet the conditions we found over there. Public safety was our biggest issue. Not only public safety from the public at large, but safety of the people that are working there. That's some of our findings. What we've done in charge, and what we want to bring to your attention, basically, is what needs to be done now. What needs to be done now. And this shows basically our findings. Our charge was to look at the situation as it exists now, address the crucial immediate needs, look at the next steps, where do we go from here as a long-range plan, and what that long-range plan might look like. We are recommending, these are our findings and recommendations. What we found for its operations, we found about 60 documented items that are not of crises nature, but right at that level. We found there's a lot of risk, there's a lot of liability for the workers primarily. Of these 60 actions, we've documented them. We found we can probably address for this price, to get down to the bottom line, for this price we can address some of those critical issues right now, operational issues. We broke it down into operations and facilities, that is the facilities itself. This is how it's operated, and this is primarily where CDC, Center for Disease Control, was interested in looking at and helping us. And then equipment. A lot of the equipment is 35, 40 years old. It's costly to operate. So what we're recommending, and we will have a handout that will show those recommendations and what this money will buy you, we're now recommending the next step, and that is a detailed analysis, which will lead to a strategic plan for the public health laboratory for the whole state of Alaska. We've not come to any conclusions, but one of the things we want to look at is the procedures. We want to look at national trends, what's happening not only in Delaware, but every state in the union. We want to look at cost-benefit and really begin to look at these analytically and objectively, and then come up with a long-range plan. A long-range plan would be, this strategic plan would also have a budgetary plan and a plan for, in fact, implementation over a period of time. Possible outcomes, new laboratories. Clearly, our recommendation, you cannot effectively and cost-effectively renovate the lease spaces you have now, period. I mean, there's no question in our minds. It could be a lease, a built-to-suit, it could be private, or it could be state, much like the public, state crime lab. Any questions? I'm sorry,
that was great. I appreciate it. I just have one question. The 300.0, which is the bottom of the Band-Aids, that's you already have that in place? That's probably for Brian.
Mr. Chairman, we have renovation and repair money in the 94 capital request. We also have $500,000 in our request for the study that's shown in the second bubble there. We feel that the $350,000 to $400,000 number is a better number now that we have the advice of these experts, and we would hope that we could use the balance for the renovation and repair. With the competing interests of the department, we would hate to dip into the facilities maintenance budget to do some of the equipment purchases and life safety issues that are mentioned in the black box, the Band-Aids.
Thanks. I can meet with you later on, too.
Please. Appreciate it.
Any other questions of committee members? Is there anyone else in your team that needed to add to this?
No, sir. We're fine. We have a handout for you that will give you more detailed information, and a final report will be forthcoming when the consultants return home and put it all together.
Great. Thank you. Sorry to keep you waiting all afternoon. Okay. Let's take some. There's no particular order of these. I'm trying to think the ones that'll go fast. Is there anyone here to testify on House Bill 148, Administrative? Is there? I guess if everyone wants to testify, we can take it. We've tried to keep it brief. Is it controversial to the members of the committee? Okay. It is? Okay. Then let's just go ahead. Let's just go through this one. First person to speak on it is Susan Warner. I'd like to bring up House Bill 148.
We can go together.
Okay. Is the other person Wendy? Oh, no. Joanna?
Loving Bellier.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. We're trying to sponsor on this way, too. Representative Terry.
Okay. I'll tell you what. Maybe it would be more fair to give the prime sponsor the chance to speak first.
Doesn't matter to us.
Well, let's take up a different bill. Let's give Gene. How about HJR 30? Is someone from Representative Byron's office here?
Mr. Chairman, Dwayne Peoples, Division of Public Health for HJR 30, the quarantine issue.
Okay.
For brevity's sake and recognition of your schedule, the Division of Public Health and Department of Health and Social Services supports HJR 30, urging the federal government to reinstate quarantine and epidemiological capacity in Alaska to look at foreign influxes of disease and other travelers and immigration.
Any questions of committee members? Senator Ellis.
Through the chair, Mr. Peoples, when did the federal government discontinue this operation in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, I believe they discontinued it in 85.
And do you know how much money the federal government had committed to this?
Mr. Chairman, I believe they had one physician up here. I do not know the total amount of funds they had available.
Further questions? Committee members? Senator Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Joint Resolution Number 30 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Okay. Any objection? That's so ordered. Let's go back to House Bill 148. I see Representative Terrio is here. I'd like to give him a chance to speak first, and then I'll call on people who have signed up to testify.
Are we on teleconference?
Yeah, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In June of 1991, the Alaska Supreme Court found that the university was not specifically excluded from the provisions of the Administrative Procedures Act until such time that the legislature specifically excluded them. The university first came under the APA provisions back in 1977 when the university at that time was going through somewhat of a fiscal crisis. And the legislature wanted them to live under the Fiscal Procedures Act and the Executive Budget Act. And as a part of trying to address that that concern at the time, they also fell under the APA, except the language then said, except to the extent that its inclusion was inconsistent with statutes defining the authority of the regions. The legislative record from that time clearly shows that the intent was that the constitutional and statutory language would allow the regions to retain control of the internal workings of the university. However, the court, in reaching its conclusion, did not consider the intent and ruled that the APA would apply unless the legislature gave a specific exemption to the university. The Administrative Procedures Act is specifically designed to deal with problems that arise mainly out of boards and commissions. If you're an individual and you apply for a real estate license and you're turned down, or if you own a liquor store and have your liquor license revoked, that is the type of action that the APA is specifically designed to take care of. It's not designed to be a grievance policy for student grievances and personnel grievances at the university. The university did have their own grievance procedure in place for a number of years, well, since its inception, and what we're trying to do here is go back to that type of system where the university will have their own grievance policy that's worked out between the administration of the university and the different campus groups. And the legislation before you has a grandfather provision in it that any grievance that was started prior to the effective date of this legislation would continue to work its way through the APA mechanism. Anything started then after that date would fall under the university's own internal grievance procedure. And with that, Wendy Redmond is here from the university, and she can talk about specifics or answer specific questions that you have.
Any questions, committee members? Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Perio, do you know if the FY94 budget for the university presumes the passage of this bill?
I don't believe that it does, and the expected cost of this bill in the university system is $200,000 to $250,000 a year.
I see that, and I just wanted to know if we can expect to see a $200,000 deletion if we pass this bill.
I don't believe that money was specifically put in there. I think it's just something the university system would have to absorb.
Okay.
The APA process is very expensive. Generally, what they do is for a hearing officer is they hire through a private attorney's firm an attorney to be the hearing officer, and they pay a flat fee of it's a fat fee too. it's $100 an hour, and some of these things can be very, very expensive.
Other questions? Representative Senator Salem.
Thank you. A question that I have is apparently an alternate grievance procedure, both for employees or students, is not necessarily in place, in all campuses. From your comments and from some of the written materials, I assume that that's the situation. Am I correct?
Ms. Redmond can answer that question probably better than I. They are ready to put something in so that there's not a gap. And I guess I'd like to defer to her.
Other questions? Okay. Next, I apologize for the day. I'd like to go back to calling on Susan Warner and Joanna Loving-Nibelier. Sure, got your name a little off. You can stay for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Susan Warner.
My name is Joanna Loving-Nibelier.
And we are classified employees at the university here in Juneau. We gave you our one-page letter of our perspective on the university and the APA. Given about a 24-hour period, we had a third of the employees in Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan state that we would like to respectfully request that you table the attempt to remove the university from the APA until a formally approved alternate grievance policy is in place, which it is not at this point in time from the employee perspective.
Senator Sayle.
Thank you. I mean, I share your concern of not having an alternative plan in place. But I wonder how long you think it'll take to get an alternative plan in place.
I think that most of the employees have great confidence that the administration and the employees can work it out in a timely manner. Wendy Redmond was saying that they were hoping that they could try to get something passed this June. The employees are just concerned that we complete the review process before we're taken out from the very specific guidelines that the APA provides. Were there some kind of provision for allowing us to be under the APA until that formal agreement is made between the internal university governance structure, the General Assembly, and the University Board of Regents? I think that that would suit most people. It's just we're not quite there yet.
Senator, you can continue.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and this really isn't a question, but it's just sort of a statement. I think that this legislation is likely to move over people's objections, but and probably for some good reasons. I mean, that this is an expensive procedure to accomplish something that maybe we can accomplish better in another way. But one of the ways, I don't know, this has an effective date clause that says immediately, but if the effective date clause were not adopted, it would give at least 90 days.
For a contingent.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that your comments are valuable regarding the need for some time to put something else into effect.
Mr. Chairman? May I also add that I don't know if everyone in the room is aware that the university employees do not have a bargaining unit to represent them, so they do need to work from within their internal governance structure. It's my understanding that the typical kinds of grievance procedures that are relevant to employees are generally evolved through negotiations between the administration and whatever your bargaining unit representation is. But the university has a slightly different structure, so anything that can be done to stop the passage of this particular intent until there's that agreement between the university administration and the university governance structure would be greatly appreciated.
Okay. Are there other questions?
I'd also like to just add this, saying something about when it took effect. It would be very much appreciated by the employees.
Okay, thank you very much. Wendy Redman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Wendy Redman, Vice President of the University. And I will skip a lot of the background information on this. I think most of you, certainly those of you who were here last year, understand the issue. I have a great deal of understanding for what Ms. Warner is talking about. There's a lot of concern on the part of employees right now. There's a lot of fear. We're looking at reduced budgets. Employees are concerned about layoffs, terminations, reductions in grade and rank. And clearly it's in the employee's best interest to have a grievance procedure in place that makes it as difficult as possible for us, for the administration, to capriciously take any kind of actions. I think, however, there's some misunderstanding, and I'd like to just clarify that. The university had in place a grievance procedure before the APA process was laid on it. It wasn't a perfect process, but the employee governance group worked for over a year and developed a new grievance procedure, which was just about ready to be put in place. It was held in abeyance until we got the court ruling, at which time the court ruling had to supplant that. Our intention would be to take that last grievance policy, which was the one that had gone through the governance process, and put that into place on an interim basis, that is, until the June board meeting, if this bill passes prior to that time. That policy is right now being circulated to the governance groups, asking them to re-review it, take a look at it again, because it's been several years, and a lot of the governance groups have changed, but go back and take a look at that policy again and see if you want to make any additional changes in it. There are many provisions of that in fact, are similar to things that are in the APA. It provides more there's a more formal process for employees, including representation by attorneys in certain kinds of cases if they wish to have that. So our intention would be, and I spoke with Ms. Werner earlier, and I think she'd prefer to have the bill, in fact, specify it, but our preference would be to not mess around with the effective date, that it's important to us to get it through. But the president of the university, I know, would be more than willing to, in fact, if it will make the employees feel better, to commit to them the exact policy that will be put in place pending final approval by the governance groups once the APA is passed, so that they know exactly what's going to be there and so that there's no gap in coverage. So I urge you to pass it. I'm concerned about, there was a motion made on the House side having to do with a delay in the effective date until such time as a policy was passed. An attorney looked at it and really felt that what was happening there was that you were putting in an effective date that in effect had two groups that could nullify a law that you just passed. First, the Board of Regents, and second, the University Assembly, and that just wasn't a good way to pass a law. It may be that you could put a letter of intent along with the policy that said, we don't want you to put it in place until such time as you have another policy in place. But my belief is that the majority of employees would be comfortable if we put the policy in place that was last approved by the governance groups as an interim measure until they had a chance to do a final review of it.
Senator Zale.
Thank you. How many different grievance procedures do you anticipate are going to replace the Administrative Procedures Act?
There's one grievance procedure. However, there are different aspects to it. For instance, if we are dealing with tenured faculty member, there's a separate process of review and so on that goes on with that. And for certain student grievances, there's a separate process. But for all other employee grievances, there's a single process. They can select different options. There's a formal process and an informal process. But there's a fairly simple peer review process that is the standard at colleges and universities all over the country, that's based on a peer review group that's established at each campus that does the initial review. There are appeal rights then up through the president.
Who hears it initially?
A grievance panel. It's a specially trained group of people who are selected from the governance groups themselves to serve on a grievance panel. Now, I believe, maybe you can help me with this, Susan, at Juneau before, did they have a separate grievance panel for staff and one for faculty and one for students, or did one grievance panel handle all?
I believe the grievance councils have not been used yet under the old system that I know of. Joanne is sitting on the current grievance council, but has not yet received any training, nor has her case.
It's a nice campus room. Grievances.
But a follow-up is, was your answer three or one? Process, procedure,
it's really
booklet.
One
it's
grievance
one.
Process.
Okay.
Yes.
Senator Levine? Oh, sorry, what do you think?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Levine?
Why do you need the immediate effective date instead of something delayed longer? Do you have that alternative? I guess you have that alternative almost in place, is what you're saying, by the time this bill is signed.
It is in place. We can do it today.
Okay. So I guess, I should probably let you answer, but the reason probably is that you don't want to let any more enter that pipeline than you need to.
That is correct, sir. And I think that as Ms. Werner suggested, the policy that we would put in place today was last reviewed by the Assembly 2 years ago, and we want them to look at it again and see if subsequently there are additional changes that they would recommend, and I think there are. So we put it in on an interim basis until they had a full chance to review it and make some recommendations. And as I say, I think there are some recommendations so that we would do a final approval, hopefully by June. But in the interim, we'd put that one in place.
One of the things we could do, I know I sit on the Rules Committee, we could get the bill to Rules, and if you have the interim plan, in effect, it might give the members comfort that there is a an interim plan in effect before the bill goes to the floor. I don't know if that's acceptable to the committee, but we can treat it that way.
Well, Mr. Chairman, would you entertain the bill being accompanied by a letter of intent?
To what effect?
Just stating that it's the legislature's intent that the university operate under, you know, immediately. Well, I haven't written it yet, but there not being a gap time is essentially the concern.
Why don't we? I would like to move the bill today, but why don't we give you time to handwrite it out, and we can take up some other bills, and maybe we can get a copy and send it around, and then have the letter of intent with it when you bring it back up. Is that acceptable? Is there anyone else who wants to testify now on House Bill 148? Let's just set it aside.
This may be
go to another
change.
Bill.
Do you want me to scribble something out?
Please.
Okay. Let's just set it aside. We'll bring it back up later in the meeting. Next to Senate Bill 143, student loan interest rate reductions. Is there someone from? Well, there's someone from Alaska Post Secondary. I'm not sure if it was to testify or be available for questions, but I see Carol Carroll's here. I assume representing the prime sponsor.
Yes.
Could you
just
please state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Carol, and I'm here for Senator Curtula, who sends his apologies. He's up in conference committee, I believe. I believe that started. But my name is Carol, and I work for Senator Curtula. This bill, I'll be very short, this bill would reduce the interest rates on the student loan from 8 to 6%, along with some of the benefits that are happening with the rest of us, the mortgage interests that are declining prime interest rates. The Senator feels that students should be able to take advantage of those benefits also. For the last couple of years, the bond issue face value that the Student Loan Corporation has had to pay has been 6%, and they've been getting 8% from their student loans. So the Senator would urge you to consider this in a positive way, and that's the extent of my testimony.
Questions of committee members?
But I will have questions.
Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to recall some of the discussion we had on this sometime in the past two or three years when we dealt with student loans. And my understanding is that the program has been revised, and we sell bonds and repay those bonds with payments from student loans, and we have a system set up now that it's in balance or nearly so. In doing this, is the system still going to be viable? Are we going to be able to pay off those bonds? Are we able to attract bonds considerably lower than 6% so we can pay them back with 6% interest? And I think with the delay in the payment of student loans, the effective interest rate is actually considerably less than 6% to adopt this. That's several parts to that, but I'm sure you are.
Well, I think what you're asking me is what is the financial stability of the fund in the years to come? And since 1990, when we haven't been putting any more general funds into the Student Loan Corporation, there has been some concern about how long we can go without making some changes to the student loan program. And if the person, this Mary Lumet from post-secondary income, the effect of this as far as your bond counsel or your advisors say is that in the year 2000, there will have to be some decision made about how to change the program to take care of the fact that the legislature is not putting any more general funds into this program. This change would bring that date 2 years. It would bring that date in up to 2002. So we would be accelerating that fact, that decision that one has to make about the Student Loan Corporation for 2 years.
Other questions?
Wait a minute.
1998.
I was just talking to the chairman here. So you're saying you're helping to create more problems in the student loan program by this passage of this bill?
According to the projections of the bond council, when they use a growth rate of 3% for this loan fund, they say, and their assumption is, that it will accelerate the time that the Student Loan Corporation has to make a decision about whether to limit loans. So there won't be enough money for every student that applies.
Follow up on that, Mr. Chairman. I may be missing something here, but why do we want to do that?
If I may answer that, the benefit is to the student. It's already in a situation where, because we're not putting any money into it, we're going to have to make that decision anyway.
Well,
and this would at least give the students the benefit of the lower interest rates, as all of us are getting that benefit this day.
Well, follow up there. Okay, the student now, but what about the student down the road that there isn't enough money there to loan them?
That situation will be there whether we do this or not.
Well, but it speeds up the process for an additional 2 years.
According to the assumptions of the bond council, if the growth of the program is 3% and they use a default rate of 12.5. So what we're doing here is we have the most conservative assumptions that the bond council could use that would have this impact. It's not necessarily that it's going to have that. And you can talk to that if you'd like.
If I could just respond for a few minutes, because
please state your name for the record.
Mary Lou Madden, the Assistant Director of the Post-Secondary Commission. The Commission does not have a position on this bill. We are, in fact, studying the whole question of the long-term viability of the loan program, particularly in the absence of general fund and our reliance on the bond markets. And Carol is essentially correct. What moving down to 6% does is hasten the day that we have to make a decision about whether we're going to limit the way we distribute funds. Right now, we have been able to get bonds at around 6%, but 55% of our bonds have been at 8% or more. So we really are, with the 6% put in law, we would be faced with really loaning out money for less than we're borrowing it for, or very close to what we're borrowing it for. And obviously, that will erode our capital base.
Senator Lee.
Is there a better way to do this instead of setting in statute the interest rate at a fixed rate? We've been dealing with other interest rate bills that fix it at the U.S. Treasury rate or 2 points over or something like that. The problem there, of course, is you probably publish information for students, and then they need to know the answers to all of this, but. If you're going to have a problem with selling bonds, and then you know you're actually loaning money at considerably less, then that creates instability in the program.
That's certainly correct. What we are dealing with in a statutorily set interest rate is the days when the program was heavily funded by general fund. We are now like a private loan corporation. We have to go out and buy money, and we can't continually sell it at less than we buy it for, in essence. We don't have a recommendation to you yet about what needs to be done, but certainly the Commission will be coming back talking about the whole question of, does the state want to continue a loan program in the future? And if you do, some things probably have to change. Many of the private loan programs target the interest rate once a year at a certain percentage over what their cost of capital is. And it is a little less stable for students, because now you know you can borrow at 8%, or if this bill went through at 6%, but the rate is established on July 1, and students know that. And because it is tied to the capital markets, people have a fairly good idea of what it is. So I think there are other alternative ways of assuring that students get a break when the rate goes down, and at the same time assuring that there's money in the future.
Other questions of committee members? I'm willing to move the bill out. I'm not real excited about weakening the program, but I think I'm willing to let it go forward and let people consider it. I never liked it when we went to the bond program, and I know that Senator Kutula has told me he didn't like that either, and I agree with him. What's the pleasure of the committee?
I'll move the bill with individual recommendations.
Objection? The bill's moved out of committee. Okay. Next bill before us is House Bill 217, Is there someone from Representative McLean's office here? Oh, yeah. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Rena Bukovic, staff to Representative McLean. She was not able to attend today and asked me to make some comments, and I will try to make them brief. The purpose of House Bill 217 is to require Native corporations under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act to hold a miner's dividends in an interest-bearing account while the miner is in state custody. This legislation was requested by the Department of Health and Social Services and Native corporations to assure that stock dividends are protected and spent for the child's benefit while the child is in state custody. Precedence was set for this bill under a class action suit filed by the department on behalf of children in state custody after passage of the original Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. In that suit, as noted in the Hess position paper, the court ruled that trust accounts be established at Alaska banks on behalf of children in custody of the department. The process was to end when the minor reached the age of majority. In 1987, Congress amended ANCSCA and extended the alienability of Native corporation stock indefinitely. The federal amendments to ANCSCA have brought back the issue of dividend protection for children in state custody and raised the need for a permanent solution. As a result, the Department of Health and Social Services and Native corporations have requested this legislation. House Bill 217 adds a new section to corporations organized under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act requiring the corporation to set up interest-bearing accounts for minors held in state custody under the Child in Need of Aid category. The bill prohibits the corporation from using the property in the account unless approved by a court and specifies when corporations can distribute property. The House Judiciary Committee amended the bill to include minors in the custody of other states. Alaska statutes make Alaska the site of ANCSCA stock regardless of where the shareholder lives, thereby affording all shareholders, residents and non-residents alike, uniform and consistent rules regarding their ANCSCA stock. House Bill 217 has a zero fiscal note.
I have a very quick question. Yeah. There's on the line it says when a minor, and I'm wondering if there was any discussion anywhere along the line of when, whether that when should be if. Because weren't there questions about whether, aren't there some cases where a minor is not entitled to distribution? I'm not sure if that's true.
I can't answer that question. Can't answer that question.
You know where the bill goes next?
Goes to judiciary.
Okay. I'll speak to the judiciary chair.
Okay.
I think when might be the wrong thing. We also have someone from DFYS available for questions. Do committee members have questions of either Ms. Bukovic or DFYS? Senator Lehman? Rita wants to come back.
I think Rita can answer this one. The term, you know, maintaining this in an interest-bearing account, any rate of interest could be an interest-bearing account, but is there in law a definition of what that means? I mean, we talked about market rates here in the bill we had before us just previously. Is there some requirement that that be consistent with market? Is that your understanding of that phrase?
In this legislation, there's not. We wanted to stay away from the whole issue of a fiduciary responsibility and what custodianships do. So we just simply said that the Native corporation would maintain it in an interest-bearing account, assuming that it would be, a reasonable rate of interest, but it is not specified.
I just wondered if there's an implied fiduciary responsibility.
Our intent was not to have any fiduciary responsibility because then there's reporting requirements and other things that go along with that. And it would make it more complicated for the Native corporations to do so, and that was something that we wanted to make very plain.
Okay. That's probably... Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 217? Any other questions of committee members? Senator Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I would move a committee substitute for House Bill 217 Judiciary out of committee with an individual recommendation.
Any objection? So ordered. Okay. Just a second. What's this one? Next one is House Bill 97. Is there anyone who signed up to testify? No, there's someone from DFYS available for questions. Are there any? I would like a 30-second summary from DFYS on what this bill does for somebody.
The which bill?
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Elmer Lindstrom. I'm a Special Assistant to Commissioner Mall in the Department of Health and Social Services. House Bill 97 is legislation requested by the department and submitted by the House HES Committee at our request. Several years ago, there was a court decision that left the question open as to the responsibility for the state providing medical care, paying for medical care, and by implication perhaps other routine maintenance costs of children, even to the extent of room and board, for children who were technically in state custody yet living with their parents. And it had never been the intent nor the practice of the Division of Family and Youth Services to pay those costs, and yet as a result of that court decision, the door was left open for that that to be a possibility. So this simply clarifies in statute what has been practice for the regular practice of the division, simply to state that children, even though they may technically be in the custody of the state, if they are living with their parents are responsible for medical and other routine maintenance costs for those children.
Okay. Any questions of committee members? Senator Salem.
Thank you. Is this sort of the reverse of the issue that we had before us a couple of weeks ago? We were talking about children being able to get Medicaid services and still live at home rather than being institutionalized. Is this sort of the flip side of that coin?
There is no relationship between the two bills, Mr. Chairman. Are you speaking of the Medicaid, the waiver question? Or the adoption subsidy bill. There are a couple of bills that you could be referring to, but there's no direct relationship to either one.
We heard some very poignant stories from people about their inability to keep their disabled children, especially disabled children, at home. And so
we're going to get to that in the next bill.
Okay. It's not the opposite of this.
No,
the opposite of divorce
for teenagers.
Oh, this is the opposite of divorce. You can't.
In a sense.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, this is not an unusual situation where children would be under the care, living with their parents, but in the technically in custody of the state. Oftentimes, when a child has been in foster care or some other out-of-home placement, things seem to be getting back to some semblance of normalcy in the home. They return to their parents, essentially on a probationary sort of situation, and this would reflect that sort of situation.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman, I have one. But we have a retroactive effective date. I try to always flag those. They usually catch my attention. And when I was in the House, I was even look for these very carefully. And I just wondered if you could explain why we have these.
Mr. Chairman, the effective date is an artifact of when the Supreme or when the court ruling was made in the original case to deal with that question.
So, if I can continue, do we have some parents who have not met their obligation that we, in this nearly two-year time frame that we have, we'll be able to maybe use this to go and collect?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there's a tremendous potential liability to the state if this bill does not pass, but I'm not aware of any outstanding claims at this time.
Further questions? Senator Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the House Bill 97 out of committee with individual recommendation.
Any objection? Bill is moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next bill before us is House Bill 178, Medicaid for Certain Children. I prepared a Senate CS that I'd like the committee to consider.
That's it, that's an understanding.
If you want to
entertain a motion for something adoption of the CS.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have, if there is any objection to adopting committee substitute. Is there anyone who wants to testify on the Senate CS for House Bill 178? Any questions of committee members? days. Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 178 Hess out of committee with individual recommendation.
Objections? None so ordered. We're back to House Bill 148.
This is a substitute.
Senator Ellis, do you have any intent language drafted up?
Yes, several pages.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Several pages.
I was very heartened to know. Oh, by the way, thank you for that last action. And I'm heartened to see that Wendy and Miss Warner back in together. I think they're smiling somewhat. So let's. Do you want me to read this?
Yeah, I think so. We don't have it all in front of us.
It is the intent of the legislature that upon passage of House Bill 148, the university put into place the draft grievance procedure distributed to employees for review on March 22, 1993. It is the understanding of the legislature that this policy will be used as an interim procedure only until the University of Alaska General Assembly and the Board of Regents formally and jointly agree to a successor grievance policy. It is further the intent of the legislature that the University of Alaska Assembly and Board of Regents reach final approval of a successor grievance policy by June 15, 1993. And I would so move and submit this for the Secretary.
Okay, it's before us, Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I will just object for a second to say it sounds too bureaucratic for a simple letter of intent, but I'm going to withdraw my objection. I think it covers it adequately.
Is there any other objection to...
I had to tweak Wendy at least once today.
Okay, it has been moved that we adopt the letter of intent as read by Senator Ellis. Is there any further objection to the letter of intent? Okay, Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 148 with the letter of intent out of committee with individual recommendation.
I'll object just for a minute. Informally, was this agreed jointly with the two people who were working on it? Okay, I remove my objection. Any other objection? Not. 148 is out of committee. I think that completes the calendar. All right. We're adjourned.